Ah, but she was the queer old skewsha anyhow, and Olivia Trinket Holmes. And sure he was the queer old one.
Stand here, you fucking swampy, sir. Caracus.
Wollte der Bach sei ein Fluss, der Fluss sei ein Strom.
Oči da ne vidijo.
Drage poslušalke, cenjeni poslušalci, lep dober večer. V zadnjih mesecih se je ponovno matematika postavila v ospredje med dvema različnima pogledoma na svet. En je Mario Livio, astrofizik, eden od doktorjev, ki je tudi vodja enega iz od dodelkov na Hubble Space Telescope inštitutu. Sodeloval je z mnogimi Nobelovimi nagrajenci, v zadnjem desetletju se je predvsem ukvarjal z potekom ustvarjanja črnih lukenj pa možnosti pridobivanja energije iz teh formacije, supernov in pa merjanja hitrosti, širjenja vesolja in podobno. Napisal je knjigo Ali je Bog matematik, z druge strani pa je v vedno aktualni za mnoge z vedno novimi idejami povezanimi z nekaj oddaljenega od tuzemlja, pa so seveda zgodbice v Egiptu in kaj naj bi se dogajalo v piramidah. Tokrat je odgovor na piramide in pa njihov način postavitvena v Gizi, pri današnjem Kajru, podal Edward Nightingale, ki je sicer mizar in tesar, sicer zelo priznan, ki se obnavljal tudi notranje prostore papeža in sodeloval pri mnogih ekskavacijah v Egiptu skozi desetletja kot tehnični vodja. Ta je postavil novo teorijo, pač postavitve Gize, geometrije in pa matematične relacije med objekti, ki naj bi bili pač neki nosilci sporočila za bodoče civilizacije. Nekaj podobnega, kot se danes dogaja na Svalbardu, na Norveškem, kjer gradimo svojo Noetovo barko za prihodnje civilizacije, kjer se v globok bunker hranijo semena za bodoče civilizacije, semena tistih rastlin, ki jih kmalu več ne bo, oziroma vsaj tistega dobrega piradižnika, ki ga vedno redkeje okusimo. Pa poslušimo prvo pogled na matematiko strani Mario Livia iz Hubble Space Telescope Inštituta.
First people who really engaged in this very actively were maybe the followers of Pythagoras, the Pythagoreans. Pythagoras is, claimed to have said that everything is number. And his followers thought that, numbers really dominate everything in the world, from physical phenomena to emotions and so on and so forth. So for them, really, numbers and mathematics were something like some sort of a mythology. So they are really probably the ones who made this into something that's close to the divine.
But how are mathematicians today? They seem, from a humanist point of view, to be the more of a technical sort of people, but still you entitled your book, Is God a Mathematician, with a question mark, which still furthers and still makes this claim of Pythagoreans a current one.
No, I mean, the phrase, Is God a Mathematician, is actually due to physicist James Jeans in the last century. And I use the word God here like an Einsteinian God, you know, like when Einstein used to say, I don't think God plays dice. He really wasn't talking about God as such. What the meaning of this is how come mathematics is as powerful as it is in terms of explaining the universe?
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you write extensively about this, whether it's an invention or a discovery.
And
right. This explains quite a lot about our reality. So what would you say? Is it an invention or is it a discovery? And how do these two prisms intermingle?
So what I argue in the book after, you know, a long discussion is that this question is actually not posed correctly. When you ask, is mathematics is an invention or a discovery, this seems to imply that it has to be either that or the other, but it cannot be both. And in fact, I argue that mathematics is an intricate combination of inventions and discoveries. To put it very broadly, humans invented the concepts, but then discovered the relations among those concepts. For example, the ancient Greeks invented the concept of an axiom. So, you know, they based all the geometry on axioms. If you look, for example, at Chinese mathematics, they did not treat it with axioms. So the concept of axiom was invented by humans. But once the concept was invented, you know, all the theorems and the relations among those theorems were discovered.
Mm-hmm. And these relations are the ones that say more about the reality than the invention itself.
Correct. Although the inventions themselves were related, of course, to a reality. I mean, you know, when people say that between every two points there is a single straight line, I mean, this was based on some sort of an experience. So it was based in some sense on the reality, the invention too.
Dr. Livio, you already said something about it, but there could be an entire sea of possibilities for the development of different mathematics.
Yes.
Even numbers are not necessary for its development, although mostly when we think of maths, at least lay people think of numbers. Could you tell us what circumstances led the human beings to develop the maths that we have, and what sort of maths could be developed in different surroundings?
So I believe that the particular mathematics that we have, the particular brand of mathematics, which was developed mostly by the Babylonians and the Egyptians, and then, of course, following that by the Greeks, is largely based on our very particular perception system. We humans are very, very good at seeing, for example, edges of things. So we can tell that one object is different from another object. This is because the way our perception system works. And as a result, it was very, you know, this led to this invention of numbers as, you know, as aggregation of objects, which you count them and so on. Similarly, we are very good at distinguishing straight lines. Very good, we can see whether something is a circle or an ellipse. We have a very high power in distinguishing such things. And this has probably led to the type of geometry that we had. You know, imagine that you would have had intelligence residing in some isolated jellyfish at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Such a jellyfish might have only experienced things like temperature and pressure and motion of the water. An intelligence of that type might have not invented the same type of mathematics. There was nothing there to count in particular, so there was no particular reason to invent the natural numbers, and certainly not the type of geometry that we have. We could have come up with things like, you know, cellular automata. These are like small computer programs that are based on simple rules of, you know, how do you arrange in pebbles or things like that and so on. So we could have come up with different brands of mathematics, but I believe that our mathematics is largely the result of our perception system.
So would you say, I mean, at the beginning of history, or if we look at different cultures, the Maya, the Vedas, and then, of course, Babylonian mathematics, Egyptian mathematics, they do have a lot of similarities, but although also they differ in some aspects. Could you tell us about these differences and why we ended up with our present maths, why we adopted the system that we did? Is it the most successful one of all?
So basically, I mean, you know, the Mayans and Egyptians and so on, they still use the same perception system as you know, the Babylonians and the Greeks and so on. So their mathematics were not that different. You know, they were all based at the end, at some level, on arithmetic and some form of geometry. Now, of course, once these different civilizations started communicating, then what happened is, you know, what I call in the book the Microsoft effect, which is, you know, the whole world is using the Microsoft system, and this is not because this is the only possible one or, you know, the inevitable one, but once you start communicating, then what happens is that in order to be able to facilitate communication, then everybody has to somehow adapt to the same system. So eventually, we came up with a situation where everybody at the end is using the same type of notation for mathematics, which was, of course, was not the case at the beginning, and you're really using the same type of language in mathematics.
Dr. Livio, there is a lot of branches of mathematics today. I mean, I know lay people are confused about the number of them. I don't know how it is with mathematicians, but in previous centuries we've had in previous centuries we've had the development of group theory, which you write extensively about, and then there is chaos theory, which is supposed to be a very useful tool as well. Has the scope of reality of the natural world, of our surrounding, that could be explained with mathematics, became larger with these new theories, or just better in explaining the reality?
Both larger and better, I would say. You know, at the time of Aristotle, for example, Aristotle was not using any mathematics for physics. You know, he was using arguments, you know, such as, yeah, of course a feather will fall slower than a piece of lead, you know, and so on. And there were no formulae and no mathematics involved. Of course, today, physics cannot move one step without mathematics. Fields of the type that you describe, like group theory, it is really a language that describes all the symmetries of the world, and people who do high-energy physics today, or, you know, the theory of subatomic particles, again, cannot move one step without group theory. So there is no question that the new branches of mathematics both allowed us to tackle areas which we were unable to tackle before. For example, probability and statistics allow us to tackle even phenomena in social sciences and so on, and at the same time also allow us to tackle better problems in areas which started early on with mathematics, like physics, for example.
All right, but since this field got so much enlarged, could you tell us what the limitations of mathematics are today?
Yes, so of course, there are still many, many limitations to treatment of everything by mathematics, as everybody knows very well. I mean, the current economic crisis, mathematics did not help us in predicting it. In fact, some even argue that some mathematics even helped in producing this economic crisis. The problem is that there are entire areas that are not very well suited for to be treated by mathematics. You know, since I mentioned the economy, then, you know, there are a variety of quantities which do not naturally allow themselves to quantitative measurement. For example, the psychology of the masses. And once you have a situation like this, then it is very difficult to treat it with mathematics. Similarly, when you have situations where you cannot do repeated experiments and expect precisely the same probabilities of outcomes, those areas, again, do not allow themselves to very good mathematical treatments. And again, economy is one such example. Now, we also know, you mentioned chaos theory in a previous question, and chaos theory has taught us that there are some systems that they are so sensitive to the initial conditions, namely, you know, you start the system slightly in a different state than you started it before, then there is no way to predict the final result. So there are some limitations that are not technical. I mean, there are limitations in principle. Since if you have a system that is infinitely sensitive to the initial conditions, then you will never be able to predict the final result because you can never tell what the initial conditions were with an infinite accuracy. So, for example, I mean, if you ask me, could we ever predict the weather to a level that we would know what every atom in the atmosphere is doing? The answer is no. And it is not a matter of how big our computers are, because we cannot tell the initial conditions of the weather to a level that we know infinitely accurate what every atom was doing to begin with. Now, this, of course, does not prevent us from having, fairly reliable weather forecasts in general, you know, where we don't know what each atom is doing, but we still know more or less what's happening in general. So we are continuously improving on the ability of mathematics to do things, but there are entire areas where mathematics is doing very, very little. I mean, both, of course, in social sciences, but even in biological sciences and many other areas. And when we talk about the successes of mathematics, it is really people applying mathematics to areas where they know that at some level mathematics will succeed, like fundamental physics.
V naslednjem delu dr. Livio razloži, kako je matematika zavedno spremenila odnos človeka do svojega okolja.
Yeah, absolutely, there is a relation. You know, if you look at what we call modern, everything we call modern today actually was largely influenced by or is attributable to science. And the great triumphs of science started in the 17th century, a little bit before that, maybe with Copernicus, but then, you know, with Galileo, Newton, Descartes, who introduced really mathematical theory into description of science, and that absolutely changed our entire worldview. Suddenly things that, you know, were considered to be the work of God suddenly became subject to very precise mathematical rules that describe them. And this is really a turning point in the history of human culture. I mean, if you take somebody like Aristotle could converse very easily with a typical Renaissance man of the 15th or 16th century. And, you know, they would understand each other. But Aristotle could not have conversed with somebody like Newton, for example, because of the lack of mathematical rigor in the discussion. I mean, to people before the beginning of the 17th century, the universe had a purpose, and that purpose was concerned with humanity. You know, the Earth was at the center, and everything was concerned with humanity. Starting with the 17th century, the Earth became just a small planet around, you know, moving around an average star, and the universe might or might not have a purpose, but purpose no longer entered into any discussion of scientific matters. So, and this is largely due to the use of mathematics. So, yes, mathematics played a very, very important role in defining what we call modern.
In pa še njegovo mnenje v nerganju mnogih, oziroma vsaj nekaterih politikov, da, oziroma naravoslovcev in matematikov, da je v družbenem življenju upravljanja vse premalo ljudi s tovrstno izobrazbo.
So, it is certainly the case that there aren't big mathematicians today among, you know, world leaders and so on. Although I will point out that in the U.S. Now a Nobel laureate, well, not there is no Nobel Prize in mathematics, but a Nobel laureate in the sciences has been appointed to at least lead one of the departments. So this is, of course, you know, a new thing. But, you know, I will tell you, you probably would not want most mathematicians to lead the world. I mean, many of the mathematicians, you know, while they deal very, very well with the abstract world of mathematics or sometimes theoretical physics, they are not particularly savvy when it comes to things like politics and so on. So I don't think we would want mathematicians to run the world. I think you would want scientists and mathematicians in general to be consulted when it comes to questions in which they are experts in. And I think that occasionally does happen, maybe should happen a little bit more, but certainly you don't need, you know, to have the president or prime minister of a country be necessarily a mathematician. It was Plato who thought that, you know, world leaders of society should also be very proficient in mathematics. And, you know, even George Washington once mentioned that it would be good for them to know mathematics. But he really meant that in the sense that it teaches you certain tools of logic, you know, and so on, which you can use. And I believe that is probably true, but they don't need to be practicing mathematicians. Now, can mathematics help us get out of the current trouble? As I pointed out before, mathematics has been, it's not that mathematics has not been used in economics. Of course, there have been many mathematical tools developed for financial systems and so on, but as I pointed out, the economy contains many, many variables which don't allow themselves to be naturally either measured quantitatively or to for modeling that, you know, you can be sure that the results are repeatable and falsifiable. So it is not clear that mathematics will take us out of the current financial crisis, even though, of course, some elements that have been developed for financial systems do work, you know, in terms of predicting trends and things of that nature. And I'm sure that they will be used. But overall, it's not as if mathematics is some magical wand that you can, you know, wave and problems are going to be solved. I mean, as I pointed out, mathematics is very, very effective in very particular area, in particular when it deals with very fundamental theories, but not when it deals with incredibly complex social systems and so on. This is not to say that in the future, maybe mathematical tools will not be developed that can do more than they can do today, in the same way as, you know, physics was once non-mathematical and now became entirely mathematical. But certainly there are limitations there. And, you know, I would certainly hope that all the policies and things that are being put in place, you know, are not guided by some mysterious formulae that are supposed to solve the problems. I mean, the problems are really much more complex than that. So we shouldn't wait for mathematics to save us from our current problems.
Okay. Dr. Livio, one more question. You spoke of the future a little bit earlier. Do you see in the near future any new breakthroughs in mathematics in explaining some of the fundamental realities of the nature?
So, well, this would certainly be more breakthroughs in physics. Of course, our current best candidate for a theory that unites all the forces of nature is called string theory. And string theory is a highly, highly mathematical theory. And in fact, many of the mathematical tools used in this theory are being, you know, discovered and invented as we speak. So there is no question that this is one place where, you know, we want to see whether or not this is the correct theory, and it would certainly, you know, benefit from, and already has benefited from, large mathematical advances.
Naš drug sogovornik Edward Nightingale pa je postavil svojo novo teorijo, povezano z matematiko, jezikom, v katerem so stari Egipčani na platoju Gize zapisali svoje sporočilo bodočim civilizacijam. Sicer bolj osamljen v tej ideji, ga je pa podprl eden od priznanih egiptologov, vsaj najbolj znanih med egiptologi, John Anthony West, tisti, ki je v začetku 90-ih dokazal, da je svinga stara med 10.000 do 5.000 pred našim štetjem, z ugotovitvijo, da so določeni deli posledica erozije vode, in pač povezal z obdobjem, ko naj bi na zadnje tam deževali v takšni meri. No, poslušimo, kako se je lotil zadeve Edward Nightingale.
Well, how I approached this, too, just let me just touch on that a little bit. How I approached this was I was looking at, as an architect would, and doing what they call an as-built blueprint, going in and trying to see what has been constructed and try to find the geometry that was used by the original architects and try to, you know, find a center and find relevant lines and put the whole thing together as a picture with the different geometry from each of the different pyramids and, you know, what were they trying to say there. One of the biggest mysteries is, you know, why there's no hieroglyphs or there's no markings or inscriptions of any kind, really, in the whole plateau. And my point of view is that the geometry is the language that was used there. They were trying to explain or leave information there. And if you were to do that, if you would have to leave information for a much distant, people, you would have to, you couldn't use language. Language would change over time, and you couldn't really use symbols because they would change as well. But one thing you could use would be math, and how you would express that would be in through geometry, through proportion. And that's what I believe I found there is information, high science, and a lot of information on harmonics and understanding light, actually.
Prepričan je, da je to Noetova barka znanja, ki jo zapušča Egipt.
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly what they did, whether, I don't want to get into, who left it or how we actually got the knowledge in the first place. I think that'll all probably come out as this investigation proceeds here and other people get a chance to look at what I've got. That's essentially, I think, how I see it there is, there's information put in there for us to find at some point, and it was done purposefully just for that reason. I could be wrong, but I believe through my research and what I've found, I think I can go a long way to at least give this some further look.
All right, so you've put forward quite an interesting idea. Can you explanation, not an idea, but an explanation to the layout of the Giza Plateau? Could you explain it to us, please?
Yes. The Giza Plateau consists of a total of 9 pyramids. The 3 main pyramids is the Pyramid of Khufu, and then the second pyramid, which is in the middle, is the Pyramid of Khafre, and then there's the Pyramid of Menkaure. That was 3 different builders took place building that, the Khufu, and then his son Khafre, and then Menkaure was Khafre's son. So it was built over a period of 3 generations in those particular things there. But as far as what I think was going on there, what they were doing here is trying to encode this knowledge of understanding of harmonics and stuff. So what they were trying to do there is they were looking at how to put this information down there. It would have to be in certain mathematics and proportions. It would have to be understood. So what I did was I found what I claim to be is a center point of which would be an axis of this circle. And once I started drawing concentric circles, I realized they were definitely going off of this one center point of which all other measurement was taken. And that is a line, if you draw from north to south along the western face of the Pyramid of Khufu, and then draw a line west to east through the center line of the Pyramid of Khafre, those 2 points cross at the temple in front of the Pyramid of Khafre, which is the exact spot where the angled causeway that runs down to the Sphinx, which is at a 15-degree angle. So I saw those 3 points merge right there at that point, and the angled causeway to me looked like the hand of a clock. So I started doing some measuring and checking into that, and there's another angled causeway that goes into the eastern center of the Pyramid of Khufu, which is also at an angle. And when I drew a line along that angle and connected it to the western side of the center line for the Pyramid of Khafre, they intersected. And then I took those 2 points, the intersection and the axis, and I drew a circle. And everything pretty much fell in a really nice proportion using that as my start point to find the diameter of the circle. And everything pretty much started falling into place at that point. The dividing the circle again in half led to direct relationships to the satellite pyramids next to Menkaure. And by drawing a one-third diameter circle in the middle of our circle, touched on the western face of Khafra, and a corner, that would be the east, the southeastern corner of Khufu, and proportions as we're going working down here wound up being a quarter and a third and a fourth, which to me, being a musician as well, I understand tunings, and I knew the ancient tunings all were in 432. So this proportional geometry right away, you know, it was telling me 432. So I just kept working these proportions and seeing where they were essentially putting like hands of a clock in there, which would give me certain angles of degree around a 360-degree circle. And when I found those angles, which were a 45-degree angle, which would divide the circle into eight, and then there was a 40-degree angle, which would divide it into nine, 360 degrees into nine. And I realized the Egyptians worked with a proportion of eight to nine, and there was also the gods, the Ogdoag and the Enad, I believe it is, the gods were eight and nine. So right away, these numbers that were coming out here made very good sense as to, you know, how they would do things. So it just kind of has been developing from that, and it's still developing as we speak. I mean, the more I look at it, the more I find and keep refining it, but it's all pointing in the direction that I was thinking here.
In kakšna je matematika okolja, o katerem on govori, in pa pač matematičnih relacijah še, ki naj bi jih odkril, ki naj bi ga stara egipčanska civilizacija poznala.
Well, they you know, they've used math a little differently than we did, but they use mainly fractions when they were doing proportion, and the question has always been, well, did they know pi, and did they know the different golden ratios and things like that? And they expressed pi as 22 over 7 as a fraction, and we express it as 314. So they were very well aware of this. Maybe they didn't exactly express it like we did, but I think I can go a long way to show that they very much knew math. And a lot of what I come up here to with this 432, and getting back into a little bit of the numbers that I found, is you know, this 432 is the sound of the Om and the Hindu and Tibetan Om, and it's also the frequency used as the Amen in Christianity, and it was the Native American flute tunings and all. Well, it's a very important frequency, and if you square that, square 432, you come up with 186,624, which is, if you were trying to explain or leave a message to somebody about light, you couldn't ask for two better numbers there to explain this. And the Egyptians' measurements were done in cubits, and there was two types of cubits. There was a royal cubit, which measures in inches as 20.61 inches, and then there was a plain cubit that measured 18 inches. Now, that word cubit, according to Laird Scranton, he has a book called Science of the Dogons, which is very good. I saw him at CPAC out in California when we were there this past October, and he has brought forward information based from the word cubit is actually translated into Achmet, which means light measure. So literally the word cubit that the Egyptians measure in and their measurements are based literally translate to light measure. And then expanding on that a little bit, the word pyramid itself in Greek would be pyra, which would mean either fire or light, and the mitos, I think it is or mid for the last portion there would be measure again. So here we have the cubit being light measure, and the pyramid being also light measure. And they, like I said, these numbers and proportions that I found in there literally point toward understanding light and harmonics and frequencies.
Kakšne pa pričakuje, da bodo posledice v širše gledano do jemanju zgodovine in človeških civilizacij, če se spozna njegova teorija za pravilno?
I think it's got huge implications, to be quite honest with you. If what I propose comes out to be correct, we're going to have to completely change the way we think of what they knew. But I honestly think that a lot of people kind of feel and know that already, that our history isn't all what they're telling us it is. And, there's so many out-of-place artifacts and just contradictions of the current way of thinking. You know, we need to think things happen a little bit more cyclical than... You know, civilizations rise and fall and come and go, and we really haven't been taught that, you know, and it's starting to become pretty obvious now, and this is just going to be something they're going to have to deal with. You know, I'm just redrawing what they drew, and when you take that information and put it together, you know, you'll come up with the same kind of answers I have. So it'll be interesting, and it will. It's we're going to have to re-look at history and explain why if they knew what they're saying they have encoded here. If they knew that, then we got a major change in how we have to look at it. And it's very basic geometry, and this is not, it implies a lot, and there's a lot to it, but this basic geometry is there. It's pretty hard to argue. So.
Kako pa je na njega kot na mizarja in tesarja zaželjenega tako strani papeža, da mu popravi in uredi notranje prostore, kot tudi mnogih drugih, ali cerkva, te vere, ali one, ali pa pač pri obnavljanju egipčanskih starin. Kako je vplivala simbolika vseh teh ver na njegovo razmišljanje?
When I originally started looking into this whole thing about 13 years ago or so, I started really looking at religious symbols to start with, and was looking at, you know, well, why did they make their symbols like this, and the heraldry and different things like that. That was actually where some of my geometry began. It was only at the end of that search in symbolism that I actually found and put it together with the Giza Plateau. Which kind of makes sense when you look back on the whole thing. It naturally went that way. But yes, the symbolism, I am not discovering this. I'm rediscovering it, and there are other people and that know exactly what I have here. This isn't, it certainly isn't out in the public, based on the geometry and symbolism, I can pretty much tell you that there are groups of people that do know exactly what I have here.
Well, but could you share for our public some one or two details about what you have there?
Well, I think what I can do here at the end of all this is when you start putting the symbols I mentioned in the paper article that I did here, I mentioned that I've applied it to different Knights Templar seals, different Masonic symbols. The Great Seal of the United States of America, and if they didn't know this, or if this was a coincidence, there's a whole lot of coincidences going on, geometrically speaking. I think that there are people that know exactly what I have here. I'll just, you know, leave it at that at this point.
To je bil Edward Nightingale, za konec pa še mnenje Livija, predvsem o poslednjih zadevah, o katerih je govoril predhodni sogovornik.
No, I personally believe that all of those are, you know, are myths. It is of course the case that in some of the things you mentioned, I mean, some mathematics was used. For example, in the building of the pyramids, if you look at the Ahmes papyrus, which is, you know, this ancient document from about 1600 BC on mathematics, then you will find that the ancient Egyptians knew very well what the concept of a slope of, you know, was, and they used that concept extensively in building the pyramid. So there were some mathematics used in there, but many of the other things that you mentioned are really nothing more than myths. Some of them were created by all kinds of mystical or semi-mystical cults, and others were created simply early on when people did not make a distinction between things that, you know, can be described by a scientific theory and things that are, you know, just mystical. So yeah, I do not put much weight on claims of that type.
Za tokratno podajo Oči, da ne vidijo, sem poskrbil Matej. Lep večer in lahko noč.
Wollte der Bach sei ein Fluss, der Fluss sei ein Strom.
Oči, da ne vidijo.